She watched him turn into the lamplight which fell up the stair, descending. He passed out of sight, but she could still hear him. She heard him in the hall again, fast, and after a while she heard the horse again, galloping. And after a while, the sound of the horse ceased. A clock was striking one somewhere when Joe urged the now spent old horse through the main street of town. The horse had been breathing hard for some time now, but Joe still held it at a stumbling trot with a heavy stick that fell rhythmically across its rump. It was not a switch. It was a section of broom handle which had been driven into Mrs. McEachern's flower bed in front of the house for something to grow on. Though the horse was still going through the motion of galloping, it was not moving much faster than a man could walk. The stick, too, rose and fell with the same spent and terrific slowness, the youth on the horse's back leaning forward as if he did not know that the horse had flagged, or as though to lift forward and onward the failing beast, whose slow hooves rang with a measured, hollow sound through the empty and moon-dappled street. It, the horse and the rider, had a strange, dreamy effect, like a moving picture in slow motion as it galloped steady and flagging up the street and toward the old corner where he used to wait, less urgent perhaps, but not less eager, and more young. The horse was not even trotting now, on stiff legs, its breathing deep and labored and rasping, each breath a groan. The stick still fell. As the progress of the horse slowed, the speed of the stick increased in exact ratio. But the horse slowed, shearing into the curb. Joe pulled at its head, beating it, but it slowed into the curb and stopped, shadow-dappled, its head down, trembling, its breathing almost like a human voice. Yet still the rider leaned forward in the arrested saddle, in the attitude of terrific speed, beating the horse across the rump with the stick. Save for the rise and fall of the stick and the groaning respirations of the animal, they might have been an equestrian statue strayed from its pedestal and come to rest in an attitude of ultimate exhaustion in a quiet and empty street splotched and dappled by moonshadows. Joe descended. He went to the horse's head and began to tug it, as if he would drag it into motion by main strength and then spring onto its back. The horse did not move. He desisted. He seemed to be leaning a little toward the horse. Again they were motionless, the spent beast and the youth facing one another, their heads quite near, as if carved in an attitude of listening or of prayer or of consultation. Then Joe raised the stick and fell to beating the horse about its motionless head. He beat it steadily until the stick broke. He continued to strike it with a fragment not much longer than his hand. But perhaps he realized that he was inflicting no pain, or perhaps his arm grew tired at last because he threw the stick away and turned. World, already in full stride. He did not look back. Diminishing, his white shirt pulsing and fading in the moon shadows, he ran as completely out of the life of the horse as if it had never existed. He passed the corner where he used to wait. If he noticed, thought at all, he must have said, "My God, how long ago that was." The street curved into the gravel road. He had almost a mile yet to go, so he ran not fast but carefully, steadily, his face lowered a little as if he contemplated the spurned road beneath his feet, his elbows at his sides like a trained runner. The road curved on, moon-blanched, bordered at wide intervals by the small, random, new, terrible little houses in which people who came yesterday from nowhere and tomorrow will be gone where not, dwell on the edges of towns. They were all dark, save the one toward which he ran. He reached the house and turned from the road, running, his feet measured and loud in the late silence. Perhaps he could see already the waitress, in a dark dress for traveling, with her hat on and her bag packed, waiting. How they were to go anywhere, by what means depart, likely he had never thought. And perhaps Max and Mame, too, likely undressed. Max coatless, or maybe even in his undershirt, and Mame in the light blue kimono. The two of them bustling about in that loud, cheerful, seeing-someone-off way. But actually he was not thinking at all, since he had never told the waitress to get ready to leave at all. Perhaps he believed that he had told her, or that she should know, since his recent doings and his future plans must have seemed to him simple enough for anyone to understand. Perhaps he even believed that he had told her he was going home in order to get money when she got into the car. He ran onto the porch. Heretofore, even during his heyday in the house, his impulse had been always to glide from the road and into the shadow of the porch and into the house itself where he was expected, as swiftly and inconspicuously as possible. He knocked. There was a light in her room and another at the end of the hall, as he had expected. And voices from beyond the curtained windows, too. Several voices which he could discern to be intent rather than cheerful. That he expected too, thinking, perhaps they think I am not coming. That damn horse. That damn horse. He knocked again, louder, putting his hand on the knob, shaking it, pressing his face against the curtained glass in the front door. The voices ceased. Then there was no sound whatever from within the house. The two lights, the lighted shade to her room and the opaque curtain in the door, burned with a steady and unwavering glare, as if all the people in the house had suddenly died when he touched the knob. He knocked again, with scarce interval between. He was still knocking when the door. No shadow had fallen upon the curtain, and no step had approached beyond it, fled suddenly and silently from under his rapping hand. He was already stepping across the threshold as if he were attached to the door when Max emerged from behind it, blocking it. He was completely dressed, even to the hat. "Well, well, well," he said. His voice was not loud, and it was almost as if he had drawn Joe swiftly into the hall and shut the door and locked it before Joe knew that he was inside. Yet his voice held again that ambiguous quality. That quality hearty and completely empty and completely without pleasure or mirth, like a shell, like something he carried before his face and watched Joe through it, which in the past had caused Joe to look at Max with something between puzzlement and anger. "Here's Romeo at last," he said. "The Beale Street playboy." Then he spoke a little louder, saying Romeo quite loud. "Come in and meet the folks." Joe was already moving toward the door, which he knew, very nearly running again, if he had ever actually stopped. He was not listening to Max. He had never heard of Beale Street, that 3 or 4 Memphis City blocks in comparison with which Harlem is a movie set. Joe had not looked at anything, because suddenly he saw the blonde woman standing in the hall at the rear. He had not seen her emerge into the hall at all, yet it was empty when he entered. And then suddenly she was standing there. She was dressed in a dark skirt, and she held a hat in her hand. And just beyond an open dark door beside him was a pile of luggage, several bags. Perhaps he did not see them. Or perhaps looking saw once, faster than thought, "I didn't think she would have that many." Perhaps he thought then for the first time that they had nothing to travel in, thinking, "How can I carry all those?" But he did not pause, already turning toward the door which he knew. It was only as he put his hand on the door that he became aware of complete silence beyond it, a silence which he at 18 knew that it would take more than one person to make. But he did not pause. Perhaps he was not even aware that the hall was empty again, that the blonde woman had vanished again without his having seen or heard her move. He opened the door. He was running now. That is, as a man might run far ahead of himself and his knowing in the act of stopping stock still. The waitress sat on the bed as he had seen her sitting so many times. She wore the dark dress and the hat as he had expected, known. She sat with her face lowered, not even looking at the door when it opened, a cigarette burning in one still hand that looked almost monstrous in its immobility against the dark dress. And in the same instant, he saw the second man. He had never seen the man before, but he did not realize this now. It was only later that he remembered that, and remembered the piled luggage in the dark room which he had looked at for an instant while thought went faster than seeing. The stranger sat on the bed too, also smoking. His hat was tipped forward so that the shadow of the brim fell across his mouth. He was not old, yet he did not look young either. He and Max might have been brothers in the sense that any two white men strayed suddenly into an African village might look like brothers to them who lived there. His face, his chin where the light fell upon it, was still. Whether or not the stranger was looking at him, Joe did not know. And that Max was standing just behind him, Joe did not know either. And he heard their actual voices without knowing what they said, without even listening. Ask him. How would he know? Perhaps he heard the words, but likely not. Likely they were as yet no more significant than the rasping of insects beyond the closed-drawn window, or the packed bags which he had looked at and had not yet seen. He cleared out right afterward, Bobby said. He might know. Let's find out if we can just what we are running from at least. Though Joe had not moved since he entered, he was still running. When Max touched his shoulder, he turned as if he had been halted in mid-stride. He had not been aware that Max was even in the room. He looked at Max over his shoulder with a kind of furious annoyance. "Let's have it, kid," Max said. "What about it?" "What about what?" Joe said. "The old guy. Do you think you croaked him? Let's have it straight. You don't want to get Bobby in a jam." "Bobby," Joe said, thinking, "Bobby, Bobby." He turned, running again. This time Max caught his shoulder, though not hard. "Come on," Max said. "Ain't we all friends here? Did you croak him?" "Croak him?" Joe said, in that fretted tone of impatience and restraint, as if he were being detained and questioned by a child. The stranger spoke. "The one you crowned with the chair. Is he dead?" "Dead?" Joe said. He looked at the stranger. When he did so, he saw the waitress again, and he ran again. He actually moved now. He had completely dismissed the two men from his mind. He went to the bed, dragging at his pocket, on his face an expression both exalted and victorious. The waitress did not look at him. She had not looked at him once since he entered, though very likely he had completely forgot that. She had not moved. The cigarette still burned in her hand. Her motionless hand looked as big and dead and pale as a piece of cooking meat. Again, someone grasped him by the shoulder. It was the stranger now. The stranger and Max stood shoulder to shoulder, looking at Joe. "Quit stalling," the stranger said. "If you croak the guy, say so. It can't be any secret long. They are bound to hear about it by next month at the outside." "I don't know, I tell you," Joe said. He looked from one to the other, fretted but not yet glaring. "I hit him. He fell down. I told him I was going to do it someday." He looked from one to the other of the still, almost identical faces. He began to jerk his shoulder under the stranger's hand. Max spoke. "What did you come here for, then?" What did? Joe said. What did I? He said, in a tone of fainting amazement, glaring from face to face with a sort of outraged yet still patient exasperation. What did I come for? I came to get Bobby. Do you think that I... When I went all the way home to get the money to get married? Again, he completely forgot, dismissed them. He jerked free and turned to the woman with once more that expression oblivious, exalted and proud. Very likely at that moment the two men were blown as completely out of his life as two scraps of paper. Very likely he was not even aware when Max went to the door and called, and a moment later the blonde woman entered. He was bending above the bed upon which sat the immobile and down-looking waitress, stooping above her, dragging the wadded mass of coins and bills from his pocket, onto her lap and onto the bed beside her. Here. Look at it. Look. I've got. See? Then the wind blew upon him again, like in the schoolhouse 3 hours ago, among the gaped faces there, of which he had for the time been oblivious. He stood in a quiet, dreamlike state, erect now where the upward spring of the sitting waitress had knocked him, and saw her, on her feet, gather up the wadded and scattered money and fling it. He saw quietly her face strained, the mouth screaming, the eyes screaming too. He alone of them all seemed to himself quiet, calm. His voice alone quiet enough to register upon the ear. You mean you won't? He said. You mean you won't? It was very much like it had been in the schoolhouse. Someone holding her as she struggled and shrieked, her hair wild with the jerking and tossing of her head. Her face, even her mouth, in contrast to the hair, as still as a dead mouth in a dead face. Bastard. Son of a bitch. Getting me into a jam that always treated you like you were a white man. A white man. But very likely to him, even yet, it was just noise, not registering at all. Just a part of the long wind. He just stared at her. At the face which he had never seen before, saying quietly, whether aloud or not he could not have said, in a slow amazement, Why, I committed murder for her. I even stole for her. As if he had just heard of it, thought of it, been told that he had done it. Then she too seemed to blow out of his life on the long wind like a third scrap of paper. He began to swing his arm as if the hand still clutched the shattered chair. The blonde woman had been in the room some time. He saw her for the first time, without surprise, having apparently materialized out of thin air, motionless, with that diamond-surfaced tranquility which invested her with a respectability as implacable and calm as the white lifted glove of a policeman, not a hair out of place. She now wore the pale blue kimono over the dark garment for traveling. She said quietly, Take him. Let's get out of here. There'll be a cop out here soon. They'll know where to look for him. Perhaps Joe did not hear her at all, nor the screaming waitress. He told me himself he was a nigger. The son of a bitch. Me effing for nothing a nigger son of a bitch that would get me in a jam with clodhopper police. At a clodhopper dance. Perhaps he heard only the long wind, as swinging his hand as though it still clutched the chair, he sprang forward upon the two men. Very likely he did not even know that they were already moving toward him. Because with something of the exaltation of his adopted father, he sprang full and of his own accord into the stranger's fist. Perhaps he did not feel either blow, though the stranger struck him twice in the face before he reached the floor, where, like the man whom he had struck down, he lay upon his back, quite still. But he was not out because his eyes were still open, looking quietly up at them. There was nothing in his eyes at all. No pain, no surprise. But apparently he could not move. He just lay there with a profoundly contemplative expression, looking quietly up at the two men, and the blonde woman still as immobile and completely finished and surfaced as a cast statue. Perhaps he could not hear the voices either, or perhaps he did and they once more had no more significance than the dry buzzing of the steady insects beyond the window. Bitchin' up as sweet a little setup as I could have wanted. He ought to stay away from bitches. He can't help himself. He was born too close to one. Is he really a nigger? He don't look like one. That's what he told Bobby one night. But I guess she still don't know any more about what he is than he does. These country bastards are liable to be anything. We'll find out. We'll see if his blood is black. Lying peaceful and still, Joe watched the stranger lean down and lift his head from the floor and strike him again in the face, this time with a short, slashing blow. After a moment he licked his lip a little, somewhat as a child might lick a cooking spoon. He watched the stranger's hand go back, but it did not fall. That's enough. Let's get on to Memphis. Just one more. Joe lay quietly and watched the hand. Then Max was beside the stranger, stooping too. We'll need a little more blood to tell for sure. Sure. He don't need to worry. This one is on the house too. The hand did not fall. Then the blonde woman was there too. She was holding the stranger's lifted arm by the wrist. I said, that will do. Chapter 10. Knowing, not grieving, remembers a thousand savage and lonely streets. They run from that night when he lay and heard the final footfall and then the final door. They did not even turn the light out, and then lay quietly on his back, with open eyes while above the suspended globe burned with aching and unwavering glare, as though in the house where all the people had died. He did not know how long he lay there. He was not thinking at all, not suffering. Perhaps he was conscious of somewhere within him the two severed wire ends of volition and sentience lying, not touching now, waiting to touch, to knit anew so that he could move. While they finished their preparations to depart, they stepped now and then across him, like people about to vacate a house forever will across some object which they intend to leave. Here, Bobby, here, kid, here's your comb, you forgot it. Here's Romeo's chicken feed, too. Jesus, he must have tapped the Sunday school till on the way out. It's Bobby's now. Didn't you see him give it to her? Didn't you see old big-hearted? That's right. Pick it up, kid. You can keep it as an installment or a souvenir or something. What, don't she want it? Well, say, that's too bad. Now, that's tough, but we can't leave it lay here on the floor. It'll rot a hole in the floor. It's already helped to rot one hole pretty big for its size, pretty big for any size. Hey, Bobby. Hey, kid. Sure, I'll just keep it for Bobby. Like hell you will. Well, I mean, I'll keep half of it for Bobby. Leave it there, you bastards. What do you want with it? It belongs to him. Well, for sweet Jesus, what does he want with it? He doesn't use money. He doesn't need it. Ask Bobby if he needs money. They give it to him that the rest of us have to pay for it. Leave it there, I said. Like hell, this ain't mine to leave. It's Bobby's. It ain't yours neither unless... Sweet Jesus, you're going to tell me he owes you Jack too? That he has been effing you two behind my back on credit? I said, leave it. Go chase yourself. It ain't but $5 or $6 apiece. Then the blonde woman stood above him and stooping. He watching quietly, she lifted her skirt and took from the top of her stocking a flat, folded sheaf of banknotes and removed one and stopped and thrust it into the fob pocket of his trousers. Then she was gone. Get on, get out of here. You ain't ready yet yourself. You gotta put that kimono in and close your bag and powder your face again. Bring my bag and hat in here. Go on now, and you take Bobby and them other bags and get in the car and wait for me and Max. You think I'm going to leave either one of you here alone to steal that one off of him, too? Go on now, get out of here. Then they were gone. The final feet, the final door. Then he heard the car drown the noise of the insects, riding above, sinking to the level, sinking below the level, so that he heard only the insects. He lay there beneath the light. He could not move yet, as he could look without actually seeing, hear without actually knowing. The two wire ends not yet knit as he lay peacefully, licking his lips now and then as a child does. Then the wire ends knit and made connection. He did not know the exact instant, save that suddenly he was aware of his ringing head, and he sat up slowly, discovering himself again, getting to his feet. He was dizzy. The room went round him, slowly and smoothly as thinking, so that thinking said, not yet. But he still felt no pain, not even when, propped before the bureau, he examined in the glass his swollen and bloody face and touched his face. "Sweet Jesus," he said. "They sure beat me up." He was not thinking yet. It had not yet risen that far. "I reckon I better get out of here. I reckon I better get out of here." He went toward the door, his hands out before him like a blind man or a sleepwalker. He was in the hall without having remembered passing through the door, and he found himself in another bedroom while he still hoped, perhaps not believed, that he was moving toward the front door. It was small, too. Yet it still seemed to be filled with the presence of the blonde woman. Its very cramped, harsh walls bulged outward with that militant and diamond-surfaced respectability. On the bare bureau sat a pint bottle almost full of whiskey. He drank it, slowly, not feeling the fire at all, holding himself upright by holding to the bureau. The whiskey went down his throat, cold as molasses, without taste. He set the empty bottle down and leaned on the bureau, his head lowered, not thinking, waiting perhaps without knowing it, perhaps not even waiting. Then the whiskey began to burn in him, and he began to shake his head slowly from side to side, while thinking became one with the slow, hot coiling and recoiling of his entrails. "I got to get out of here." He re-entered the hall. Now it was his head that was clear and his body that would not behave. He had to coax it along the hall, sliding it along one wall toward the front, thinking, "Come on now. Pull yourself together. I got to get out." Thinking, "If I can just get it outside, into the air, the cool air, the cool dark." He watched his hands fumbling at the door, trying to help them, to coax and control them. "Anyway, they didn't lock it on me," he thought. "Sweet Jesus, I could not have got out until morning then. It never would have opened a window and climbed through it." He opened the door at last and passed out and closed the door behind him, arguing again with his body, which did not want to bother to close the door, having to be forced to close it upon the empty house where the two lights burned with their dead and unwavering glare, not knowing that the house was empty and not caring any more for silence and desolation than they had cared for the cheap and brutal nights of stale, oft-used glasses and stale, oft-used beds. His body was acquiescing better, becoming docile. He stepped from the dark porch into the moonlight, and with his bloody head and his empty stomach, hot, savage, and courageous with whiskey, he entered the street which was to run for 15 years. The whiskey died away in time and was renewed and died again, but the street ran on. From that night the thousand streets ran as one street, with imperceptible corners and changes of scene, broken by intervals of begged and stolen rides, on trains and trucks, and on country wagons with he at 20 and 25 and 30 sitting on the seat with his still, hard face and the clothes, even when soiled and worn, of a city man, and the driver of the wagon not knowing who or what the passenger was and not daring to ask. The street ran into Oklahoma and Missouri, and as far south as Mexico, and then back north to Chicago and Detroit, and then back south again, and at last to Mississippi. It was 15 years long. It ran between the savage and spurious board fronts of oil towns where his inevitable serge clothing and light shoes black with bottomless mud, he ate crude food from tin dishes that cost him $10 and $15 a meal, and paid for them with a roll of banknotes the size of a bullfrog, and stained too with the rich mud that seemed as bottomless as the gold which it excreted. It ran through yellow wheat fields waving beneath the fierce yellow days of labor and hard sleep in haystacks, beneath the cold, mad moon of September and the brittle stars. He was in turn laborer, miner, prospector, gambling tout. He enlisted in the army, served 4 months and deserted and was never caught. And always, sooner or later, the street ran through cities, through an identical and well-nigh interchangeable section of cities without remembered names, where beneath the dark and equivocal and symbolical archways of midnight, he bedded with the women and paid them when he had the money, and when he did not have it, he bedded anyway, and then told them that he was a Negro. For a while it worked. That was while he was still in the South. It was quite simple, quite easy. Usually all he risked was a cursing from the woman and the matron of the house, though now and then he was beaten unconscious by other patrons, to waken later in the street or in the jail. That was while he was still in the, comparatively speaking, South. Because one night it did not work. He rose from the bed and told the woman that he was a Negro. "You are?" she said. "I thought maybe you were just another wop or something." She looked at him, without particular interest. Then she evidently saw something in his face. She said, "What about it? You look all right. You ought to have seen the shine I turned out just before your turn came." She was looking at him. She was quite still now. "Say, what do you think this dump is anyhow? The Ritz Hotel?" Then she quit talking. She was watching his face, and she began to move backwards slowly before him, staring at him, her face draining, her mouth open to scream. Then she did scream. It took 2 policemen to subdue him. At first they thought that the woman was dead. He was sick after that. He did not know until then that there were white women who would take a man with a black skin. He stayed sick for 2 years. Sometimes he would remember how he had once tricked or teased white men into calling him a Negro in order to fight them, to beat them or be beaten. Now he fought the Negro who called him white. He was in the North now, in Chicago and then Detroit. He lived with Negroes, shunning white people. He ate with them, slept with them, belligerent, unpredictable, uncommunicative. He now lived as man and wife with a woman who resembled an ebony carving. At night he would lie in bed beside her, sleepless, beginning to breathe deep and hard. He would do it deliberately, feeling, even watching his white chest arch deeper and deeper within his ribcage, trying to breathe into himself the dark odor, the dark and inscrutable thinking and being of Negroes, with each suspiration trying to expel from himself the white blood and the white thinking and being. And all the while his nostrils at the odor which he was trying to make his own would whiten and tauten, his whole being writhe and strain with physical outrage and spiritual denial. He thought that it was loneliness which he was trying to escape and not himself. But the street ran on. Cat-like, one place was the same as another to him. But in none of them could he be quiet. But the street ran on in its moods and phases, always empty. He might have seen himself as in numberless avatars, in silence, doomed with motion, driven by the courage of flagged and spurred despair. By the despair of courage whose opportunities had to be flagged and spurred. He was 33 years old. One afternoon the street had become a Mississippi country road. He had been put off a southbound freight train near a small town. He did not know the name of the town. He didn't care what word it used for name. He didn't even see it anyway. He skirted it, following the woods, and came to the road and looked in both directions. It was not a graveled road, though it looked to be fairly well used. He saw several Negro cabins scattered here and there along it. Then he saw, about a half mile away, a larger house. It was a big house, set in a grove of trees. Obviously a place of some pretensions at one time. But now the trees needed pruning and the house had not been painted in years. But he could tell that it was inhabited, and he had not eaten in 24 hours. That one might do, he thought. But he did not approach it at once, though the afternoon was drawing on. Instead, he turned his back upon it and went on in the other direction, in his soiled white shirt and worn serge trousers and his cracked, dusty, town-shaped shoes, his cloth cap set at an arrogant angle above a 3 days' stubble. Yet even then he did not look like a tramp. At least apparently not to the Negro boy whom he met presently coming up the road and swinging a tin bucket. He stopped the boy. "Who lives in the big house back there?" he said. "That where Miss Burden stay at." "Mr. and Mrs. Burden?" "No, sir. Ain't no Mr. Burden. Ain't nobody live there but her." "Oh, an old woman, I guess." "No, sir. Miss Burden ain't old. Ain't young, neither." "And she lives there by herself. Don't she get scared?" "Who going to harm her right here at town? Colored folks around here looks after her." "Colored folks look after her?" At once it was as if the boy had closed a door between himself and the man who questioned him. "I reckon ain't nobody round here going to do her no harm. She ain't harm nobody." "I guess not," Christmas said. "How far is it to the next town over this way?"
"About 30 miles, they say." "You ain't fixin' to walk it, is you?"
"No," Christmas said. He turned then, going on. The boy looked after him. Then he too turned, walking again, the tin bucket swinging against his faded flank. A few steps later he looked back. The man who had questioned him was walking on, steadily though not fast. The boy went on again in his faded, patched, scant overalls. He was barefoot. Presently he began to shuffle, still moving forward, the red dust rising about his lean, chocolate-colored shanks and the frayed legs of the two short overalls. He began to chant, tuneless, rhythmic, musical, though on a single note, "Say don't didn't, didn't don't who, won't dat yaller gal's puddin' don't hide." Lying in a tangle of shrubbery 100 yards from the house, Christmas heard a far clock strike 9 and then 10. Before him the house bulked square and huge from its mass of trees. There was a light in one window upstairs. The shades were not drawn, and he could see that the light was a kerosene lamp, and now and then he saw through the window the shadow of a moving person cross the further wall. But he never saw the person at all. After a while, the light went out. The house was now dark. He quit watching it then. He lay in the copse, on his belly, on the dark earth. In the copse, the darkness was impenetrable. Through his shirt and trousers, it felt a little chill, close, faintly dank, as if the sun never reached the atmosphere which the copse held. He could feel the never-sunned earth strike, slow and receptive, against him through his clothes. Groin, hip, belly, breast, forearms. His arms were crossed, his forehead rested upon them, in his nostrils the damp, rich odor of the dark and fecund earth. He did not look once again toward the dark house. He lay perfectly still in the copse for more than an hour before he rose up and emerged. He did not creep. There was nothing skulking nor even especially careful about his approach to the house. He simply went quietly, as if that were his natural manner of moving, and passed around the now dimensionless bulk of the house, toward the rear, where the kitchen would be. He made no more noise than a cat as he paused and stood for a while beneath the window where the light had shone. In the grass about his feet, the crickets, which had ceased as he moved, keeping a little island of silence about him like thin yellow shadow of their small voices, began again, ceasing again when he moved with that tiny and alert suddenness. From the rear of the house a single-story wing projected. "That will be the kitchen," he thought. "Yes, that will be it." He walked without sound, moving in his tiny island of abruptly ceased insects. He could discern a door in the kitchen wall. He would have found it unlocked if he had tried it. But he did not. He passed it and paused beneath a window. Before he tried it, he remembered that he had seen no screen in the lighted window upstairs. The window was even open, propped open with a stick. "What do you think about that?" he thought. He stood beside the window, his hands on the sill, breathing quietly, not listening, not hurrying, as if there were no need for haste anywhere under the sun. "Well, well, well. What do you know about that? Well, well, well." Then he climbed into the window. He seemed to flow into the dark kitchen, a shadow returning without a sound and without locomotion to the all-mother of obscurity and darkness. Perhaps he thought of that other window which he had used to use and of the rope upon which he had had to rely. Perhaps not. Very likely not. No more than a cat would recall another window. Like the cat, he also seemed to see in the darkness as he moved as unerringly toward the food which he wanted as if he knew where it would be. That, or were being manipulated by an agent which did know. He ate something from an invisible dish with invisible fingers. Invisible food. He did not care what it would be. He did not know that he had even wondered or tasted until his jaw stopped suddenly in mid-chewing, and thinking fled for 25 years back down the street, past all the imperceptible corners of bitter defeats and more bitter victories, and 5 miles even beyond a corner where he used to wait in the terrible early time of love for someone whose name he had forgot. 5 miles even beyond that it went. "I'll know it in a minute. I have eaten it before somewhere. In a minute I will." Memory clicking, knowing. "I see. I see. I more than see. Hear. I hear. I see my head bent. I hear the monotonous, dogmatic voice which I believe will never cease, going on and on forever. And peeping, I see the indomitable bullet head, the clean, blunt beard, they too bent, and I thinking, how can he be so not hungry, and I smelling my mouth and tongue weeping, the hot salt of waiting, my eyes tasting the hot steam from the dish. "It's peas," he said aloud. "For sweet Jesus. field peas, cooked with molasses. More of him than thinking may have been absent. He should have heard the sound before he did, since whoever was creating it was trying no more for silence and caution than he had. Perhaps he did hear it. But he did not move at all as the soft sound of slippered feet approached the kitchen from the house side of it, and when he did at last turn suddenly, his eyes glowing suddenly, he saw already beneath the door which entered the house itself the faint approaching light. The open window was at his hand. He could have been through it in a single step almost. But he did not move. He didn't even set down the dish. He did not even cease to chew. Thus he was standing in the center of the room, holding the dish and chewing, when the door opened and the woman entered. She wore a faded dressing gown and she carried a candle, holding it high so that its light fell upon her face. A face quiet, grave, utterly unalarmed. In the soft light of the candle she looked to be not much past 30. She stood in the door. They looked at one another for more than a minute, almost in the same attitude. He with the dish, she with the candle. He had stopped chewing now. "If it is just food you want, you will find that," she said in a voice calm, a little deep, quite cold. Chapter 11. By the light of the candle she did not look much more than 30. In the soft light down falling upon the soft, ungirdled presence of a woman prepared for sleep. When he saw her by daylight, he knew that she was better than 35. Later, she told him that she was 40, which means either 41 or 49 from the way she said it, he thought. But it was not that first night, nor for many succeeding ones, that she told him that much even. She told him very little anyway. They talked very little, and that casually, even after he was the lover of her spinster's bed. Sometimes he could almost believe that they did not talk at all, that he didn't know her at all. It was as though there were two people, the one whom he saw now and then by day and looked at while they spoke to one another with speech that told nothing at all since it didn't try to and didn't intend to. The other with whom he lay at night and didn't even see, speak to, at all. Even after a year, he was working at the planing mill now, when he saw her by day at all, it would be on Saturday afternoon or Sunday, or when he would come to the house for the food which she would prepare for him and leave upon the kitchen table. Now and then she would come to the kitchen, though she would never stay while he ate, and at times she met him at the back porch, where during the first 4 or 5 months of his residence in the cabin below the house, they would stand for a while and talk almost like strangers. They always stood. She in one of her apparently endless succession of clean calico house dresses and sometimes a cloth sunbonnet like a country woman. And he in a clean white shirt now and the serge trousers creased now every week. They never sat down to talk. He had never seen her sitting save one time when he looked through a downstairs window and saw her writing at a desk in the room. And it was a year after he had remarked without curiosity the volume of mail which she received and sent, and that for a certain period of each forenoon she would sit at the worn, scarred, roll-top desk in one of the scarce used and sparsely furnished downstairs rooms, writing steadily, before he learned that what she received were business and private documents with 50 different postmarks, and that what she sent were replies, advice, business, financial, and religious, to the presidents and faculties and trustees, and advice, personal and practical, to young girl students and even alumni of a dozen Negro schools and colleges through the South. Now and then she would be absent from home 3 and 4 days at a time, and though he could now see her at his will on any night, it was a year before he learned that in these absences she visited the schools in person and talked to the teachers and the students. Her business affairs were conducted by a Negro lawyer in Memphis, who was a trustee of one of the schools, and in whose safe, along with her will, reposed the written instructions in her own hand for the disposal of her body after death. When he learned that, he understood the town's attitude toward her, though he knew that the town did not know as much as he did. He said to himself, "Then I won't be bothered here." One day he realized that she had never invited him inside the house proper. He had never been further than the kitchen, which he had already entered of his own accord, thinking, lip lifted, "She couldn't keep me out of here. I guess she knows that." And he had never entered the kitchen by day save when he came to get the food which she prepared for him and set out upon the table. And when he entered the house at night, it was as he had entered it that first night. He felt like a thief, a robber, even while he mounted to the bedroom where she waited. Even after a year, it was as though he entered by stealth to despoil her virginity each time anew. It was as though each turn of dark saw him faced again with the necessity to despoil again that which he had already despoiled, or never had and never would. Sometimes he thought of it in that way, remembering the hard, untearful, and unself-pitying and almost man-like yielding of that surrender. A spiritual privacy so long intact that its own instinct for preservation had immolated it, its physical phase the strength and fortitude of a man. A dual personality. The one, the woman at first sight of whom in the lifted candle, or perhaps the very sound of the slippered approaching feet, there had opened before him, instantaneous as a landscape in a lightning flash, a horizon of physical security and adultery, if not pleasure. The other, the man-trained muscles and the man-trained habit of thinking born of heritage and environment with which he had to fight up to the final instant. There was no feminine vacillation. No coyness of obvious desire and intention to succumb at last. It was as if he struggled physically with another man for an object of no actual value to either, and for which they struggled on principle alone. When he saw her next, he thought, "My God, how little I know about women when I thought I knew so much." It was on the very next day. Looking at her, being spoken to by her, it was as though what memory of less than 12 hours knew to be true could never have happened, thinking, "Under her clothes she can't even be made so that it could have happened." He had not started to work at the mill then. Most of that day he spent lying on his back on the cot which she had loaned him, in the cabin which she had given him to live in, smoking, his hands beneath his head. "My God," he thought, "it was like I was the woman and she was the man." But that was not right either, because she had resisted to the very last. But it was not woman resistance, that resistance which, if really meant, cannot be overcome by any man for the reason that the woman observes no rules of physical combat. But she had resisted fair, by the rules that decreed that upon a certain crisis one was defeated, whether the end of resistance had come or not. That night he waited until he saw the light go out in the kitchen and then come on in her room. He went to the house. He did not go in eagerness, but in a quiet rage. "I'll show her," he said aloud. He did not try to be quiet. He entered the house boldly and mounted the stairs. She heard him at once. "Who is it?" she said. but there was no alarm in her tone. He didn't answer. He mounted the stairs and entered the room. She was still dressed, turning, watching the door as he entered. But she did not speak to him. She just watched him as he went to the table and blew out the lamp, thinking, "Now she'll run." And so he sprang forward toward the door to intercept her. But she did not flee. He found her in the dark exactly where the light had lost her, in the same attitude. He began to tear at her clothes. He was talking to her in a tense, hard, low voice. "I'll show you. I'll show the bitch." She did not resist at all. It was almost as though she were helping him with small changes of position of limbs when the ultimate need for help arose. But beneath his hands, the body might have been the body of a dead woman not yet stiffened. But he did not desist. Though his hands were hard and urgent, it was with rage alone. "At least I have made a woman of her at last," he thought. "Now she hates me. I have taught her that, at least." The next day he lay again all day long on his cot in the cabin. He ate nothing. He did not even go to the kitchen to see if she had left food for him. He was waiting for sunset, dusk. "Then I'll blow," he thought. He did not expect ever to see her again. "Better blow," he thought. "Not give her the chance to turn me out of the cabin, too. That much, anyway. No white woman ever did that. Only a nigger woman ever give me the air, turned me out." So he lay on the cot, smoking, waiting for sunset. Through the open door, he watched the sun slant and lengthen and turn copper. Then the copper faded into lilac, into the fading lilac of full dusk. He could hear the frogs then, and fireflies began to drift across the open frame of the door, growing brighter as the dusk faded. Then he rose. He owned nothing but the razor. When he had put that into his pocket, he was ready to travel 1 mile or 1,000, wherever the street of the imperceptible corners should choose to run again. Yet when he moved, it was toward the house. It was as though, as soon as he found that his feet intended to go there, that he let go, seemed to float, surrendered, thinking, "All right, all right." Floating, riding across the dusk, up to the house and onto the back porch and to the door by which he would enter, that was never locked. But when he put his hand upon it, it would not open. Perhaps for the moment neither hand nor believing would believe. He seemed to stand there, quiet, not yet thinking, watching his hand shaking the door, hearing the sound of the bolt on the inside. He turned away quietly. He was not yet raging. He went to the kitchen door. He expected that to be locked also. But he did not realize until he found that it was open that he had wanted it to be. When he found that it was not locked, it was like an insult. It was as though some enemy upon whom he had wreaked his utmost of violence and contumely stood, unscathed and unscarred, and contemplated him with amusing and insufferable contempt. When he entered the kitchen, he did not approach the door into the house proper, the door in which she had appeared with the candle on the night when he first saw her. He went directly to the table where she set out his food. He did not need to see. His hands saw. The dishes were still a little warm, thinking, "Set out for the nigger. For the nigger." He seemed to watch his hand as if from a distance. He watched it pick up a dish and swing it up and back and hold it there while he breathed deep and slow, intensely cogitant. He heard his voice say aloud, as if he were playing a game, "Ham," and watched his hands swing and hurl the dish crashing into the wall, the invisible wall, waiting for the crash to subside and silence to flow completely back before taking up another one. He held this dish poised, sniffing. This one required some time. "Beans or greens," he said. "Beans or spinach?" "All right. Call it beans."